For decades, schools across the country have used addiction prevention programs telling students to just say no to drugs. Now, Kentucky officials say they want to try something new, a youth-focused approach. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Joining me now to talk about the new effort and how effective programs of the past have been are Kentucky Opioid Abatement Advisory Commission Executive Director Chris Evans. Thanks for being here, Chris.
Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it.
University of Cincinnati Adjunct Associate Professor for Psychiatry and Behavioral Neuroscience, Latrice Montgomery. Welcome back, Dr. Montgomery.
Hi, thank you for having me.
And Kentucky Health News reporter and editor, Melissa Patrick. Thanks for being here, Melissa.
Thanks for having me.
UC is a financial supporter of Cincinnati Public Radio. Melissa, we want to talk about this new drug prevention program for youth that Kentucky's launching, but first, let's get an understanding of the opioid crisis in the state. What are the numbers in terms of overdose deaths in Kentucky?
So the good news is that in the last Kentucky Office of Drug Control Policy report, it showed a decrease of nearly 10% of overdose deaths in Kentucky, but there's still, the number was 1,984 overdose deaths in 2023, which is way too many.
How are young people reflected in those numbers? Does it break it down that way?
That report does. The largest number between the ages of 0 and 24 fall in that 15 to 24-year-old category. In 2023, 92 young people in that age group died from drug overdose. It also shares that in young people under the age of 4, there were 9 overdose deaths. So likely that was, you would imagine, exposure to drugs in the home. Mm. And then the numbers for ages 5 to 14, there were too few to have it was less than five. Nationwide, the federal numbers show that 1 in 12 overdose deaths are among children between 12 and 17. And 1 in 5 are among those 18 to 25.
Chris, so overdose deaths have gone down a bit. They're still higher than anyone wants, of course. What are the reasons behind the decrease? What do you think is going on there?
No, I think there are a number of factors at play in this. And I think, first of all, as Melissa talked about it, we always have to acknowledge that although there's some, the numbers are going in the right direction, there was still a lot of pain that was lost by Kentuckians in this past year. The prevalence of the opportunity for folks to work together, quite honestly, and to engage across all levels is one of those things which I think is helping us to drive this in the right direction. There is a common sense amongst those who work in this space that everyone needs to pull together. Everybody needs to be in the same boat, and everybody needs to row together to make strides in this. And I think you see that when you talk to people who are working in prevention organizations, as well as those who work in the social services, that we all need to work together in terms of how we address this.
Dr. Montgomery, as I referenced a few minutes ago, for many years, drug education has been based on this idea of just say no. Can you explain how that was communicated in the DARE program, for example?
Absolutely. So the DARE program actually stands for Drug Abuse Resistance Education. And it started back in the early 80s. And essentially what would happen is a uniformed police officer would go into the classroom and discuss, you know, reasons why drugs are bad, why kids should stay away from them, and to simply just say no. And it would be done in sort of a lecture style format, question and answer. And as we now know, that sort of lecture style doesn't always resonate with youth. And so they learned that it needs to be much more interactive. And that also the incorporation of not only kind of these drug resistance skills, but also social and emotional skills. We also know that middle school tends to be the best place to integrate these sort of interventions and these campaigns, whereas the DARE program was primarily focusing on elementary school students. So it may just have been too early for that type of intervention.
So, Dr. Montgomery, you talked about this a little bit, but what has research said overall about the effectiveness of that approach, that kind of don't say no approach with an authority figure at the helm? Do programs like that prepare young people for the reality they face?
Unfortunately, no. There's been a large body of research that suggests that this approach does not work in reducing drug use. And in some cases, it actually increases drug use because the focus on the negative impacts, and you might remember, this is your brain on drugs. And it's like these different dramatic commercials encouraging kind of these bad signs of drug use that actually causes kids to become curious and actually want to do it and see for themselves. And so we quickly learned that that approach does not work at all. And so actually DARE has actually still implemented to this day, but they've actually adjusted it a bit in a new approach called Keeping It Real. And the real stands for refuse, explain, avoid, and leave. So it still kind of has this say no approach, but they've certainly, adapted it for different school levels and have tried to integrate some of the research that has been kind of informed it over the years.
We're talking about a new initiative to reduce overdose deaths in Kentucky and what research shows about what makes prevention programs successful. You can join the conversation by calling 513-419-7100, or you can email talk at wvxu.org. So, Chris, what is this new drug prevention education strategy that Kentucky Attorney General Russell Coleman has laid out? What is it, and what will it do?
So it's really a three-pronged effort to look at this and to work with others who are working in this space already. First, and what's gathered the most attention is really the statewide youth-centered prevention education initiative. That's really the better without it aspect of it, as we're calling it. Then also promoting evidence-based in-school prevention programs. There are a number of programs that are already in schools that are taking place. There are a number of options out there for schools, and we want to make sure that school districts and parents know that there are opportunities and options for them to engage in that level. So we want to encourage that as a second piece. And then third, we want to amplify and bring to attention the work of youth prevention programs that are being funded by the convention. There are a lot of individuals and organizations that are doing great work in this space, and we want to make sure to stand up and to amplify it and to highlight that work so people understand that there are options. They understand that there are people who are working this day in and day out. And so that's really the three prongs of it. Again, the better without a piece, the promotion of evidence-based in-school prevention programs, and then also supporting those programs which have been funded by the commission.
And how is that idea of better without it? How do you all see that as being different from a just say no approach?
Well, I think really one of the important things is Dr. Montgomery laid out that, research and what people have learned and seen over the years and studying this is that there is a better way in particular to engage with this generation. The telling them just what to do and how to do things is not a message which is going to resonate or take. And so the Better Without It campaign really is focusing on nurturing those five C's, as they like to call them, competence, confidence, connection, character, and compassion. It's really designed to encourage young people to make positive life choices and help build up their resilience. We know from that adverse childhood experiences has an impact on kids and their susceptibility to exposure to substance use. And so what this program does is really shine a light, again, on those strengths of kids and finding a way for them to identify and strengthen what's going on with them. And we've seen the studies have indicated that that is a better approach to dealing with kids nowadays in terms of getting them to be educated and to listen and to make positive choices in this space. And that's what we're trying to capitalize.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned these will be evidence-based strategies. Will there be any harm reduction aspects to this? I'm wondering if there will be explanations of how to use fentanyl testing strips, for example, or the distribution of Narcan.
So this, again, the Better Without It campaign really is one of those campaigns designed to deliver messaging and drive kids toward adopting those healthy attitudes. And that's what that campaign is really focused on. There are a number of programs and opportunities for efforts toward prevention. But what this effort is an educational initiative to really help kids understand how to make life positive life choices, give them examples of what that looks like, and really build up their own resilience. So that's what this campaign is going to focus on with that. Again, school-based prevention programs go through, and there are other programs which will do other types of work. But again, those three pillars that I talked about are really what this focuses on.
Melissa, have there been concerns expressed about, harm prevention strategies when it comes to addiction prevention work. I mean, I'm wondering, I think if I'm remembering, has Attorney General Coleman expressed concerns about things like needle exchange programs or Narcan? I mean, certainly nobody's suggesting needle exchange programs in high schools or middle schools, but is there a concern about harm reduction as part of these programs?
You know, I haven't heard any concerns. Because the program is so new and just getting off its feet, I think right now it's an excitement about the idea of sort of approaching harm, like this prevention effort from building up resiliency with these kids, showing them other ways and using social media in a way that is, as the Attorney General said, in ways that most of us older people won't even see because it's really targeted toward them. But what we know, though, from like when you talk about sex education, like you know, a holistic approach, sometimes, you know, you have to, this resiliency idea is really exciting and proven as evidence-based, but the bigger picture might be that there will be kids who use drugs, and maybe there should be some conversation about Narcan in particular, which the Attorney General does support, and where can you find it, and how can you have access to it, and how do you use it? So concerns, no, I've not heard those concerns about this particular program.
Yeah, and I'm sorry, I didn't mean to imply about this particular program. I guess I meant about, you know, harm reduction. I know I thought I had read that there were some out there who said, well, gosh, if you're distributing too much Narcan, is that enabling? If you're, you know, distributing some of these things, does that not discourage people from using drugs that could be harmful to them?
Well, and to that point, yes, there are concerns in that arena, and our Attorney General has been very clear that he is not a great fan of a needle exchange, a syringe exchange, and if he does support that in any way, it would be a one-to-one exchange, which is what most of our health departments do. And some people do believe that it is an enabling, but the research shows that does not support that opinion.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Montgomery, I want to talk to you about the research too. What does research tell you about discussions of harm reduction strategies, even with young people? And I'm thinking here of, you know, Narcan distribution, fentanyl strips. I'm not suggesting anybody's talking about a syringe exchange program for young students. But what does your research tell you about whether it's important or necessary or effective to have harm reduction as part of the approach?
So harm reduction is certainly an important approach, and just kind of thinking anecdotally, talking to my colleagues, many of, you know, there are some who agree with harm reduction, some who don't, but when we look at the research, what it shows is that depending on the type of prevention program, that harm reduction approach can be extremely helpful. And I'll give you an example. So there are different types of prevention programs, and so it sounds like Better Without It might be more of this universal approach where you focus on, you know, all youth, everyone in the population. But then if you look and you look at more of a selected prevention approach where there might be people who are already at risk for some reason, they may have some risk factors that puts them at increased risk of using opiates or another drug, or like an indicated approach where you're dealing with people who, like individuals who are at risk. And in those cases, those harm reduction approaches are very necessary and can be more helpful than maybe one with the general population. Not to say that it wouldn't be helpful there, but it just might, you know, you might vary based on the type of prevention that you're trying to offer. And so I think that really kind of structures how a person might look at how harm reduction works. But one thing that is very clear is that we know the just say no approach doesn't work. And so, you know, kind of whatever your kind of personal feelings are regarding harm reduction, we're seeing that in some ways we're going to have to, that has to be the part of the package that we provide, particularly when we talk about these selected and indicated prevention interventions.
And Dr. Montgomery, what about this resiliency approach? Is there research on that and how effective that is with kind of general populations of students?
Absolutely. And I think, it certainly has evidence-based components to it. And so when we think about, I mentioned risk and protective factors, and those risk factors are things that, put you in an increased risk of using drugs, such as having depression or anxiety or having, parents or peers who use. And then you also have those protective factors, like being involved in extracurricular activities or being around other positive youth who aren't engaging in drugs. And so certainly the promotion of those sort of positive activities is certainly shown to be effective. And again, it kind of speaks more to a universal approach that has been effective. But when we're talking about kind of more of these selected and indicated interventions, that's where that approach isn't as effective. But again, promoting those positive factors is certainly something that the research supports.
Is there any research about Narcan and whether it's good, bad, or neutral to make that more widely available to so that even, students, all kinds of students know how to use it and potentially save the life of a friend?
The research is mixed, but there's an overwhelming amount of support to suggest that Narcan should be available and that it would be helpful in terms of overdoses and just having people be informed about it. Because again, it's one of those things where we would like there to be abstinence and we want folks to just say no, but we're also seeing that that unfortunately isn't always the case. And so to have people armed with the necessary tools that they need in those situations can only help. So I'm seeing a much more of an increase in that sort of knowledge. But again, it just depends on, which campaign, which group you're talking to, which addiction professional you're speaking to that may have different thoughts on that.
Chris, I want to talk more about what Kentucky's going to be doing with this three-tiered approach. Is Kentucky modeling this program after any other states' efforts? I guess I'm wondering, you mentioned that these were evidence-based approaches. What kind of success have other places potentially seen with this approach?
Well, one of the things I think to highlight is that we are being innovative about this approach, quite honestly. I don't think that there's another state that is taking a statewide view on in terms of a statewide education initiative and campaign towards that. So we are leaning forward in doing this. We know that this program has worked in smaller settings, particularly in Central Florida, that they've utilized this to really engage with youth and be able to find and show examples of how that is making improvements in that area. And so that in conjunction with the research really kind of leans forward. But again, to get back to your question, we are leaning forward in this space in terms of engaging this on a straight statewide effort. And so we do look forward to trying to do that. One of the things that we've identified that's really important is making sure that we get to kids where they are. And that's one of the things that many campaigns have struggled with. And we think this is a way that does this. We will again, focus on reaching them through social media, through streaming platforms, through those things where they are naturally. And so, as has been said several times, this is not necessarily a campaign which adults are going to see as much of as kids will be more exposed to it, where we'll be actually able to target those areas where we know the kids are operating, where we'll see the space and be able to deliver the content to them. So it's pretty exciting that we are at the forefront trying to move forward on this. Again, it's evidence-based principles, but taking it to this kind of level in terms of entire state, we do think that we're one of the front runners in the nation in terms of doing this.
And Chris, as you all continue to develop this and innovate and try to kind of lean forward, as you mentioned, will there be time? I don't know if you'll be getting public feedback on the kind of tools or strategies that you're developing. Is there a time or a place for the public to kind of weigh in on and express opinions or thoughts about some of this?
Well, there's a couple of things that are taking place, and one of the things that had been mentioned previously in regards to the program is we're establishing focus groups throughout the Commonwealth, and those focus groups are primarily, quite honestly, geared towards youth to understand what messaging resonates with them, the type of places where we need to be focused, the type of messages that resonate specifically with these kids in these areas, because we recognize that kids from different parts of the states may have different interests. Different backgrounds, different experiences. So we're utilizing that piece to go through. The other thing which we're going to be doing is establishing a working group to really bring in some other voices outside to make sure that this continues to have that feed. And that will be a way that we get information in. It will be a process as we continue to roll out. And again, we look forward to collaborating with everybody and hearing voices. We and fully intend to engage with people across the state in this process. So I anticipate we'll be hearing a lot and having a lot of conversations with folks.
And Dr. Montgomery, when a program's being developed like this, what do you look for as somebody who researches this as signs of success? I mean, how can a program like this really gauge success as it's being developed and being implemented?
Sure. The first thing that I always look for in the development of any intervention, whether it be for prevention or treatment, is the integration of the end user. So the person that the, you know, in this case, the campaign is expecting to have an impact on. So if you're trying to reach young people, there needs to be some sort of young, you know, youth advisory committee board, or just some way, again, these focus groups are ways to make sure that young people's voices are represented and the both the development and the evaluation of the intervention. So that's number one. I also think that it's important to have specific outcomes laid out at the outset. So, you know, if the goal is to increase knowledge, for example, having those assessments and measures already set and in place, and having modules and different parts of the campaign that actually map on to those measures is extremely important. I also think regular assessments. And so, you know, of course, I don't know what the scheduling is in terms of the evaluation, but just having, you know, follow-up, I think is extremely important. So those pieces alone, I think, will help to determine the effectiveness of the intervention.
Okay. Well, I've been talking with Kentucky Opioid Abatement Advisory Commission Executive Director Chris Evans, University of Cincinnati Adjunct Associate Professor for Psychiatry and Behavioral Neuroscience Latrice Montgomery, and Kentucky Health News Reporter and Editor Melissa Patrick. Thank you all so much for your time today. You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WBXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Associate producer is Asiya Johnson. Technical director is Marshall Verbsky. I'm Lucy May. Thanks so much for listening.